and handed me a fresh glass of white wine. "There's Ethan!" "You're kidding me." I moved to the doorway and checked the raised dais where the band must have been setting up while the pool match was going on. Ethan sat on a wooden stool in a pool of light, head bent over his guitar. A hush settled, and then he began to sing. He wore the same outfit I'd seen him in at home, jeans, desert boots, a long-sleeve white T-shirt with a placket down the front that he'd unbuttoned partway. He looked utterly unlike the man I'd talked to earlier. His vocalizing transformed him from an ordinary mortal to someone from another realm. I blinked, trying to reconcile this image with the man I'd seen only hours before. His voice was mellow, his manner relaxed. What struck me was the soul shining through his song. Maybe it was technique, or maybe he had a natural sense of showmanship. He seemed oblivious, so absorbed in the music he might as well have been alone in the room. I checked the crowd and saw the same rapt attention. He seemed totally out of place in such a common setting, and at the same time, he seemed completely at home. It dawned on me that these people were here for him. The lounge was packed with avid fans, loyal followers who came specifically to hear him perform. I'd seen this before, this otherworldliness, and it had taken me years to sort the truth from the illusion. My second husband, Daniel Wade, was a musician. The first time I saw him, he was playing piano in a bar in downtown Santa Teresa. It was late. The air was smoky in the same way it was smoky here. I don't even remember now why I was there or whether I was in the company of someone else. Daniel, with his cloud of curly golden hair, leaned over the keys like an alchemist. He played like an angel. His talent was magic. The philosopher's stone that promised to turn base metal into gold. I saw him through a haze of longing. I fell in love, not with the man, but with a mirage. Watching him play, I'd assumed he was as remarkable a person as his music implied. I wanted to believe. I projected onto him qualities he didn't possess, qualities that only appeared to emanate from somewhere deep inside. I don't know that he was aware of the effect he had, so I can't accuse him of trickery or deception. He was accustomed to admiration, and it may not have occurred to him that his skill obscured the reality of who he was. I thought I was seeing the truth about Daniel when it was really only a reflection cast up along the wall. And now, here was Ethan Dace, whose metamorphosis had changed my very perception of him. There was something compelling in his voice, sorrow and wisdom and hope. What was he doing in Bakersfield? I couldn't imagine him rising to fame and fortune in so unlikely a place. But clearly, no one in a position to help had recognized his talent and offered him a break. Big Rat materialized at my side, saying, "Dude can sing. The guy's like a rock star. I'm impressed." Me, too. "Where the hell's this coming from? He's a douchebag." "Apparently he's not. Or maybe you can be a douchebag and talented at the same time." I stayed for the entire set. I'd expected the band to be amateurish, loud and discordant, running off covers of popular songs done better by the recording artist. Instead, they played what I had to guess were original numbers with blues and jazz undertones. At some point, Big Rat peeled off, and 11 o'clock came and went, and I realized this was way too late for me. The waitress passed, and I caught her attention, making the universal gesture for the check. She nodded and proceeded to the bar. The band took a break, and the temporary vacuum was suddenly filled with loud talk and boisterous laughter. Instead of feeling magical, it was only a bar again, badly lighted and smelling rank. The waitress returned and handed me a bifold of leather with a cash register slip hanging out like a tongue. I moved to the nearest table where the light was better. I opened the folder and looked at the list of charges that ran all the way down the page. The total was $346.75. Wait, wait. This isn't mine. I had two glasses of wine. Anna said you were running a tab. Me? Wasn't that your party? We came in together, but I wouldn't call it my party. Is now. Everybody else is gone. I looked at the check again. This has to be a mistake. Nope, don't think so. She peered over my shoulder, using her pen to refer to each item in turn. Two beers. Those were Hank's. He's a cute guy, isn't he? Ellen had three margaritas and two shots of tequila. I counted two margaritas. Are you going to argue with me over every little thing? She ordered the third one while you were in the other room watching Anna play pool. Now, see here. Anna ordered two martinis, and this is where she switched to champagne. For $290? How many glasses did she drink? She ordered a bottle. She likes Dom Perignon. She wanted the 82, but I talked her out of it. I can't believe they did this to me. Guess you don't know them very well. I could have told you straight off if you'd asked me nice. I fumbled in my shoulder bag and came up with my wallet and took out my American Express card. We don't take Amex, Visa or MasterCard. I pulled out a second card, this one, Visa. She studied it briefly. You have a photo ID? I experienced the miracle of self-control as I opened my wallet and held it up so my driver's license was clearly visible. No offense. Boss requires us to check. I'll be right back. You are too kind, I said. But she was already heading for the bar, where I saw her pass the check and my credit card to the closest bartender. Moments later, she returned with a copy of the cash register receipt and the charge slip, complete with carbons bearing the numbers she'd swiped. She held out the pen. For a moment, I struggled, trying to determine the amount of a tip. It wasn't like she'd served us food. The pay here is really crummy, she reported conversationally. We pool our tips and split with the bartenders, which doesn't leave much. Most of us can barely make ends meet, and I've got two kids. I ran the tip up another 5%, making it an even 10. It wasn't until I was going out the door that I chanced to look back. In the far room, the redhead Anna had been playing pool with was leaning up against the wall, and Ethan was using his index finger to trace a line along the low, square neckline of her dress. By some uncanny intuition, he glanced in my direction and saw that I was watching him. I made my exit before he had a chance to react. At 2:35 a.m., I sat straight up in bed. I pushed the covers back and padded across the room to the desk chair where I'd flung my shoulder bag. As is true in so many motel rooms, the glaring lights from the parking lot threw all the surfaces into high relief. I picked up my bag and dug into one of the outside pockets, feeling for my index cards. I removed the rubber band and sorted through as though preparing for a magic trick. Pick a card, any card. I flicked on the desk lamp, pulled out the chair, and settled uneasily into the leather-upholstered seat, which was chilly from the air conditioning. While I'm frugal in my use of California water, I keep a motel room at Arctic temperatures. The Holiday Inn had graciously accorded me an extra blanket that I'd pulled down from the closet shelf in its clear plastic bag. I'd gone to sleep in my usual T-shirt and underwear, blanket and spread pulled up almost over my head. Now I was aware of the cold. I returned to the bed, propped two fat pillows against the headboard, and slipped under the covers again. In checking the 1942 Polk, I'd found two Dace families, Sterling and Clara, who lived at 4619 Paradise Road, and Randall J. and Glenda living at 745 Daisy Lane. In the 1972 Polk, I found R. Terrence and Evelyn, also at 745 Daisy Lane. And I'd speculated that the couple had moved into his parents' house at some point during the intervening years. I'd also noted the names and addresses of neighbors on either side. The Pilchers, who'd lived next door to Terrence and Evelyn Dace in 1974, had since disappeared. On the other side, at 743, Lorelei Brandel was no longer in evidence, but there was an L. Brandel on Ralston. I looked up the name for the second time in the current phone book, and this time I made a note of the phone number. I turned off the light and burrowed under the covers. I woke again at 6 o'clock, disoriented, still in Bakersfield, just my luck. I'd have given anything to have been at home in my own bed. I lay there in a funk. Since I didn't intend to jog, I had time to go through my mental checklist again. By and large, I'd taken care of business. The only remaining question had nothing to do with my responsibilities as executor of the estate. I wanted to know what Evelyn Dace was up to. A man's honor was at stake, and that troubled me. I realized I'd been hoping for a way to rehabilitate Dace's reputation in the eyes of his kids. But two of the three were unreceptive, and I hadn't been able to budge them. While technically this was unpaid work, that $500,000 did suggest a different point of view. In some respects, this was the highest paid job I'd ever undertaken, and I decided I might as well satisfy myself in the bargain. I ate breakfast in the hotel coffee shop, opting for orange juice, cold cereal, buttered rye toast, and 3 cups of coffee. Once in my room again, I checked my notes. It was by then 8:35, which seemed early but not indecent for a Saturday morning call. I picked up the handset and dialed an outside line, then punched in the phone number for the L. Brandel listed on Ralston Street. I was about equally torn between wanting to succeed and wanting to fail. Chances were I was on the wrong track, and this L. Brandel was in no way related to the Brandel who'd lived next door to Terrence and Evelyn Dace. If that were the case, my job in Bakersfield was done, and I could go home. The number rang 3 times, and then a woman picked up. "Hello?" "Oh, hi. May I speak to Mrs. Brandel?" There was a moment of quiet, and I couldn't help but burble on as though adding information would change the facts. "I'm calling because I'm trying to locate a Lorelei Brandel, who lived on Daisy Lane in the early 70s. The woman said, "She can't come to the phone right now. May I ask who's calling?" "Really? This is the Lorelei Brandel who lived next door to Evelyn and Terrence Dace?" "She doesn't go by the name Lorelei. She's been Lolly since the age of 2. "Sorry. She moved here from Daisy Lane 6 years ago. Evelyn Dace remarried. I believe she's still in Bakersfield, but I have no idea where." "Would there be any way I might speak with Lolly?" There was a pause. "I'm sorry, I don't believe I caught your name." "Kinsey Milhone. Terrence Dace died this past week. He's the—" "I know who Terrence is, dear. Everyone in town knows him. If you don't mind my asking, what's this have to do with Lolly?" "It gets complicated, but basically, I'm distantly related to Mr. Dace, and I've been talking with some of the surviving family members. A question has come up about his whereabouts the night Karen Coffey was kidnapped, and I thought Lolly, might help us out." "Just one moment." I heard her clunk the handset down on a tabletop. There was a long interval of silence. Eventually, she picked up again. "I just went to check on her. She hasn't been well." I'm sorry to hear that. I drove up from Santa Teresa yesterday, and I should head back before long. I was hoping to speak to her sometime soon. Are you her caregiver? I'm her cousin, Alice. I'll keep my visit as brief as possible. I only need a few minutes of her time. Ordinarily, I wouldn't do this, Miss Milhone. She lowered her voice. No one in the family's been to visit Lolly in the past 5 years. She's 86 years old, and she's depressed. Frankly, I think a visit would lift her spirits regardless of the subject. Was that who you were talking to just now? Yes, it was. She seems to like the idea, or I wouldn't have permitted you to pursue the subject. What time were you thinking? Shortly. Actually, right now. Her silence made me think she was going to turn me down, but she said, I suppose that would do. Thanks. I really appreciate your help. I'm at the Holiday Inn near the convention center downtown. I'm looking at a Ralston Street address, but I don't know where that is. We're on the east side of the Union Cemetery. Ralston runs 2 blocks between South Owen Street and MLK Boulevard. Could you give me directions? Of course. We're only 10 blocks away. I made a note of her instructions, not even bothering to check the map because it wasn't that complicated. I returned the handset to its cradle, and the phone rang again. Hello? A woman said, May I speak to Kinsey Milhone? This is she. This is Mamie, Ethan's wife. I'm glad I caught you. I was afraid you'd be gone by now. How are you doing? I'm fine. How about yourself? I'm well, she said. There was half a beat of quiet, which I didn't want to fill with chat. Smoothly, she said. I know you and Ethan had a long talk yesterday, and we're confused about where you come into the picture. You told him Terence was your favorite uncle, but Evelyn says he didn't have any nieces or nephews. Ethan misunderstood. My father was Terence's favorite uncle. I have photographs of the two of them taken years ago. Your father? She said blankly. Randy Milhone. His mother, my paternal grandmother, was Rebecca Dace. I can't say that means much. My father was born in Bakersfield. His family and the Daces were close once upon a time. Does the name Milhone ring a bell? I'd have to ask Evelyn. It's not a name anyone's mentioned to me. You said something about photographs, but I'm not sure what those would tell us. I suppose Evelyn could take a look and see if she recognizes anyone. Unfortunately, the photos are still in Terence's safe deposit box, which I won't have access to until after the probate hearing. I wish I could be more specific about the family connections. So do I, she said. I mean, I'm not saying there's anything fishy going on, but it would be helpful if you had proof of your identity. Otherwise, it seems odd you show up out of a clear blue sky and announce you're inheriting. Can you document any of this? I gave Ethan a copy of his father's will. I'm talking about you. How do we know you're who you say you are? I can show you my driver's license and a photostat of my private investigator's license. Turn the question around and tell me how you'd prove who you are. It's easier said than done. I suppose. Is there something in particular that bothers you, or just the situation in general? A little bit of both. I've gone over the papers you left, and I'm confused about a number of things. We think we should get together today, since this might be our only chance. I paused, instantly resistant, as I sensed my trip home drifting further away. The last thing in the world I wanted to do was meet Ethan's code enforcer wife, but I thought I should at least pretend to cooperate. I'm willing to meet you, but how will that help? I suggested Ethan get legal counsel. That way his attorney and mine could handle any questions that arise. I don't want to turn this into a personal argument with him. When I said we, I wasn't talking about him. I was referring to myself. Ah, a conversation might help us sort ourselves out. Look, I'll be happy to explain how I got roped into this. What I don't want to discuss are the actual terms of the will. Oh, and why is that? Because those are legal issues. I'm not a lawyer, and as far as I know, you're not either. No, I'm not, she said. So what do you suggest? I have this morning open. I went through a quick debate. As far as I knew, she had no legal standing in the matter, and I was reluctant to subject myself to another interrogation. At the same time, she seemed to wield considerable influence in the family, which meant that winning her over might diffuse the situation. I did think it was preferable to meet face to face. I'm due back in Santa Teresa mid-afternoon, I said. If we're going to meet, it might be smart to have Evelyn on hand. She knows the family history better than either one of us, Mamie said. I don't want to complicate matters. It would be a way to avoid going through this again with her if it comes to that. With Evelyn present, she could ask questions that might not occur to me. I'm sure she'd appreciate the opportunity to express her views. You think she can be objective about this? Probably not, but the two of us can't either, so what's the difference? I'll admit I was curious about Dace's ex-wife, whose unseen presence had hovered in the background since I'd first come across her name in the divorce decree and the quitclaim in his safe deposit box. All right, I suppose that makes sense. I have an appointment coming up, but it shouldn't take long. Can we make it 10 o'clock? That should work. Fine. I'll meet you in the lobby and we can take it from there. Wonderful, she said. On impulse, I said, I saw Ethan at the Brandywine last night, she said. Really? I was certain someone had already told her as much. It was Anna's idea, I said. She brought Ellen and Hank along so I'd have a chance to meet them as well. I was actually there long enough to hear Ethan play. He's very talented. You sound surprised. I guess I am. Hard to believe he hasn't come to the attention of someone in the music business. I'm sure he'd love nothing more, except now he's got 3 little kids. And where would they be if his career took off? I experienced a quick flash of Binky gnawing on her doorknob. If Ethan left, her baby heart would break. That would be very tough. Yes, it would. My opinion, if he was so hell-bent on success, he should have pursued it before he made babies. Probably so. Mamie and I went through polite fare-thee-wells. I hung up, wishing I hadn't agreed to meet. It wasn't a conversation I was looking forward to. My curiosity about the ex-Mrs. Dace was the only draw. On my way to Ralston Street, I took a 10-minute detour, stopping at a Walgreens drugstore just long enough to buy a Whitman sampler, which I didn't think they were even making anymore. These were the Russell Stover deluxe candies, coconut, chocolate-covered cherries, nougats, all the kinds I hate. The box had a bird and a basket of flowers on the front that looked like it had been stitched in needlepoint. I could have purchased the sugar-free candy, but why bother? For $6.99, I also picked up a bouquet of daisies, alstroemeria, and some fluffy green stuff all wrapped in cellophane. I got back in the car and rolled down the windows. This was mid-October, and the day was sunny. The humidity must have been low because while the temperature posted on the bank marquee I'd passed said it was 85 degrees, the air had an autumn feel to it, as though scented with the hint of burning leaves. There was little evidence that the trees were changing colors. From the flora and fauna I could see, the evergreens outnumbered deciduous species by 3 to 1. Beyond a variety of palms, I recognized manzanita, junipers, California bay, and the coast live oak. The house on Ralston was plain, a dark green one-story box with a modest yard enclosed by a picket fence. The place would have benefited from the services of a handyman. The front gate sagged to the point where I had to lift it off the sidewalk before it would swing open. The wooden porch steps needed a coat of paint. I wasn't sure what to expect of Cousin Alice. She sounded like a young woman, but telephone voices can be deceptive. I rang the bell. A flat metal mailbox was affixed to the wall near the front door. The printed calling card visible in a small slot read, Alice Hildreth Fix. The woman who came to the door appeared to be in her 70s. I suspected she was wearing a wig because her blonde hair was too thick and glossy to be her own. She wore it in what in my day was referred to as a flip, shoulder length with the ends turned up perkily. She wore a yellow crewneck sweater and a gray tweed skirt, knee-high hose, and penny loafers. I wouldn't have guessed about the knee-highs except that she'd rolled both down around her ankles to ease her circulation. "Hi, I'm Kinsey," I said. "And you're Alice?" She opened the storm door. "I am. Lolly's mother and mine were sisters. Are those for her?" "Oh, sorry," I said, handing her the bouquet. I held out the candy box. "These are for her as well." She took both, saying, "Very nice. Won't you come in?" "Thanks. I really appreciate your letting me stop by." "Lolly's in the backyard," she said. "I'll introduce you, but I should warn you, 10 minutes from now she won't remember who you are. She suffers dementia, and she's easily confused." I felt my heart sink, wishing she'd mentioned this on the phone. My optimism faded as I followed her through the house. I'd be asking Lolly about events that occurred some 16 years before. It hadn't seemed like such a stretch when I came up with the plan. Now I wondered if there was any point.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program. Hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents W is for Wasted by Sue Grafton. This is Judy Kay. Chapter 20. Pete Walensky. July 1988, 3 months earlier. On Saturday, Pete drove over to Santa Teresa Hospital and had a long chat with the medical librarians, doing what he thought of as due diligence. He explained that he was a freelance journalist working on an article about glucotase. He said another writer had passed along preliminary notes, but Pete couldn't make heads nor tails of his handwriting. So he wasn't sure how the term was used, only that he was expected to cover the subject, which would run as a 2-part series. These two women presided over thousands of medical texts and professional journals. They also had computer resources Pete couldn't have accessed for love or money. Apparently, no one ever asked for assistance because they were soon falling all over themselves, getting him what he needed. They sat him down at a table and provided him with medical literature from which he made copious notes. He wasn't entirely clear on some of the language or the medical terms. Doctors had to fancy everything up with Latin. But the gist of it began to sink in as he read. Turned out, glucotase was an oral hypoglycemic medication manufactured by a Swiss company called Paxton Pfeiffer. The drug had been pulled off the market in 1969 after reports of users suffering serious and sometimes fatal side effects. Among them, blurred vision, anemia, and other blood disorders, headaches, hepatic porphyria, stomach pain, nerve damage caused by excessive levels of porphyrin in the liver, hepatitis, hives, itching, skin rash, and skin eruptions. Pete shook his head. Last thing in the world a diabetic needed was another load of grief. He moved on. Two recent abstracts suggested that the drug was going into phase 2 clinical trials for off-label use in combination with certain first-generation sulfonylureas in the treatment of alcohol and nicotine addiction. One of the librarians returned to his table with additional information, providing him with an abstract of a proposal submitted to the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, which was part of the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. The randomized, double-blind study was intended to develop behavioral and drug relapse prevention for individuals dependent on both nicotine and alcohol using a combination of acamprosate, naltrexone, and glucotase. According to the abstract, the aim of this study is to compare the effect of cognitive therapy in adjunct of 3 different pharmacotherapies. The sponsor was Paxton Pfeiffer, in collaboration with the Santa Teresa Research Institute at the University of California, Santa Teresa. The start date, September 1987. Estimated study completion date, September 1989. Estimated enrollment, 40. This study is currently recruiting participants, it said. Principal investigator, Linton Reed, M.D., Ph.D. Pete made a note of the 11-digit clinical trials government identifier number and then sat and thought about what he'd learned. The subject was still perplexing, but no longer opaque. When he went back to the main desk and inquired about a Dr. Stupak, first name unknown, they rustled up a Victor Stupak in an AMA publication that listed his graduation from medical school, his subsequent internship and residency, and various appointments leading up to his current position as chief of surgical oncology, Arkansas Christian Cancer Center, which was affiliated with Arkansas Christian College in Conway, Arkansas. Out of curiosity, he had them track down a photograph and bio of Linton Reed, which allowed him to trace his educational history as well. Reed had done his undergraduate work at Florida State. He remembered now that Willard had mentioned Florida State as the place where Linton and Mary Lee had met. After Florida State, Reed had been accepted at Duke, where he picked up his Ph.D. and M.D. in successive years. He then completed an internship and began his surgical residency at the very Arkansas Christian Cancer Center, where Victor Stupak, M.D., was currently ensconced. Linton Reed had been there a scant 6 months. After an unexplained gap, his career history picked up again when he was awarded a 2-year fellowship by the National Science Foundation. Pete considered putting a call through to Dr. Stupak, but didn't think he'd have much luck. These medical types could be a close-mouthed lot. Pete paid for copies of the documents he thought relevant and put them into a file folder. When he returned to his car, he put the folder into one of the boxes he was taking home. First chance he had, he'd consolidate all the paperwork, organizing the files for easy access. Pete spent way too much time hunting down documents he should have had at his fingertips. First thing Monday morning, Pete called the UCST Health Sciences building. He'd picked up the number from Willard, who was blissfully ignorant of what was going on behind the scenes. Dr. Linton Reed wasn't important enough to have a secretary of his own. The gal Pete talked to was the gatekeeper for the whole medical facility and took her job much too seriously. She mentioned her name in a clipped fashion when she picked up his call, but Pete missed it. After that, she did everything possible to thwart and obstruct his desire for a meeting. First, she claimed Dr. Reed was in his clinic office only 2 days a week, on Tuesdays and Thursdays. When Pete pressed for an appointment the next day, she wanted to know the nature of his business, suggesting it might be something she could help him with, thus saving the oh-so-important Dr. Linton Reed the bother of having to deal with the likes of him. "This is strictly personal," Pete said. "Personal" was a word that apparently had no place in this woman's vocabulary. She said, "I understand you may feel that way, but the fact remains that Dr. Reed is tied up this week. The next possible appointment is on Thursday, the 28th.
Let me tell you something, miss. What was your name again?
Greta Sobel.
What you should be aware of, Miss Sobel, is that my proposal to Dr. Reed is not only personal, it's date-sensitive. He's not going to appreciate your making my life difficult. All I need is 20 minutes of his time, so you can either work me in tomorrow or he's going to know how uncooperative you've been.
There's no reason to take that tone.
Apparently there is, given your attitude.
If you'll give me your name and number, I'll check with Dr. Reed and get back to you.
How about you figure it out right now, or I'll come over there myself and tell him what's going on. Silence.
Just one moment.
She put him on hold. He suspected she was giving herself a little breathing room to get her temper under control. She clicked back in.
1 o'clock,
he said. Thank you.
But she'd hung up on him by then.
Tuesday morning, he cruised by his office, circling the block once. He spotted his landlady's car parked in the adjacent lot and continued on his way. He drove down to the beach, following Cabana Boulevard as far as the bird refuge. He had ways to make good use of his time. Before he got out of the car, he adjusted his scarf to keep the chill off his neck. He opened his trunk and unlocked the briefcase where he kept his Glock, which he slid into the pocket of his sport coat. He extracted his gun cleaning kit from behind the boxes of books and old files that he was gradually moving from his office to his garage at home. In the event his landlady served an eviction notice, he'd be able to clear the premises in short order. He carried the kit and yesterday's newspaper to a picnic table, where he spread the first section across the crude wood surface. He set out a tin of CLP, his cleaning rags, Q-tips, a barrel brush, a cleaning rod, and an old toothbrush, and then removed the Smith & Wesson Escort from his shoulder holster and Glock 17 from his coat pocket. He worked on the Escort first, pulling the slide back to assure himself the chamber was empty. He popped out the magazine, sighted down the barrel, aimed, and dry-fired at one of the ducks, which took no interest in him whatever. He field-stripped the gun, removing the recoil spring and the barrel from the frame. He wiped down the parts, eliminating any excess lubrication, then took a dry brush and cleaned all the surfaces. He'd done it so many times he probably could have done it by feel. His mind wandered first to Dr. Reed, then to Willard, and then to his own wife, Ruthie, the love of his life. For their 40th anniversary, coming up the following year, he wanted to surprise her with a river cruise, which was why he'd picked up the brochure from the travel agent. This was something she'd always wanted to do. He liked the idea himself, gliding down a river in Germany. He imagined the quiet, the sumpy smell of inland waterways, excursions to nearby points of interest. He pictured villages, stretches of empty countryside, the occasional larger town where they might venture out to see the sights. His hope was to do it in style, maybe not first class, which they couldn't afford, but not on the cheap by a long shot. He set the Escort aside and went to work on the Glock. With his office rent in arrears, he knew the money would be better spent catching up, but he was already so far behind he couldn't see the point. He'd met Ruthie when she was a month shy of nursing school, an accelerated course she'd enrolled in after she got her AA degree. He'd finished his own education with no clear sense of what he wanted to do with his life. He'd tried a little bit of everything before he got a job doing repos for a small collection agency. Eventually, he apprenticed as a private investigator, and for a while, he felt he was where he belonged. Things hadn't quite panned out as he'd hoped. Lately, the work had dried up almost completely, leaving him scrambling to survive. He looked up. One of the on-ramp bums was standing on the path watching him. This was a big fellow he'd seen countless times. Red baseball cap, red flannel shirt, jeans, and what looked like new boots tough enough to kick a man to death. He knew people who resented the homeless, and one of them chased off the grassy areas where they loitered from day to day. His policy was live and let live. Pete said,
"Can I help you, son?"
Fellow put his hands in his pockets. He wasn't bad-looking, but he carried himself with the menacing posture of a thug. Pete gave him credit for persistence. He himself wouldn't be able to tolerate a life of begging on off-ramps or anywhere else, for that matter.
"My dad had a gun look like that. A lot of semi-automatics look similar. What's yours?"
"Glock 17.
"Is it new?"
"New to me.
The 17 came out in 1982. I didn't acquire this one until recently."
"How much does a gun like that cost?"
It crossed Pete's mind that the fellow's interest might be more than idle. With a gun in his possession, other methods of picking up pay would certainly be available. Pete said,
"More money than I got now, I can tell you that for a fact. Important thing is to handle a weapon like this with the respect it deserves. Safety comes first."
"You ever kill anyone?"
"I have not. How about yourself?"
"Not me, but my dad was in the army and he killed a bunch. Messed with his head."
"I'd imagine so."
Pete let the conversation lapse. After a minute, he looked up.
"Anything else on your mind?"
He met the panhandler's gaze, and the fellow shook his head in the negative, saying,
"Take care."
"You too."
The bum backed up a few steps and then moved off, heading toward the scrub. Pete had heard there was a hobo camp up there somewhere, but he'd never seen it himself. When he finished cleaning and reassembling the Glock, he tidied up his rags and brushes, crumpling the newsprint into a wad that he tossed into the public trash container. He holstered his pocket pistol and returned his cleaning kit to the trunk. He pulled out a bag of birdseed and took a seat on the wooden bench. He wasn't crazy about the ducks. Ducks were stupid, and the geese could turn hostile if you didn't watch your step, not that he begrudged any of them their place in the greater scheme of things. To his way of thinking, pigeons were the perfect birds, each intricately marked gray and white with touches of iridescence. The minute he opened his bag of seed, a high-pitched shriek would cut the air, a shrill announcement to any bird within range that there were treats in store. He liked that about birds, their willingness to share. He broadcast seeds in the area around him. He left a trail of seeds across the shoulders of his sport coat. The birds descended in a cloud, their wings batting and fluttering. They settled on him as though he were a tree, talons digging into the sleeves of his coat. They clustered on his lap, some flapping off and then on again. They ate from his outstretched hand. They pecked at the seeds he sprinkled in his hair. If children passed while the birds were feeding, they'd stare at Pete transfixed, recognizing the special magic known only to persons of a certain type. To the children, he must look like a scarecrow, tall and rangy and lean, crooked teeth, crooked smile, and fingers as long as sticks. He attracted birds from across the lagoon as though the wind had blown them into a darkened spiral, whirling around his head before they alighted. Fondly, he shooed them away, smiling to himself. He folded over the neck of the bag of birdseed and secured it with a rubber band. He glanced at his watch. The lunch hour was coming up, and he'd promised Ruthie he'd be home. She'd been doing private duty nursing, working as needed, which seemed to be all the time, but she was off today. Home again in the kitchen, he felt at peace. She made grilled cheese sandwiches and tomato soup. He sat down at the kitchen table, watching her flip the two sandwiches until both sides were brown. She was unusually quiet as she ladled soup into two bowls, removed the sandwiches to a cutting board, and sliced them on the diagonal before she slid them onto the plates. It wasn't until she sat down that she glanced at him with what he thought was a touch of guilt. She was looking worn, Her complexion was still clear, but her coloring had faded, and a series of fine lines now radiated from the outer corners of her eyes. Her jawline had softened and now looked more touchable. Her beautiful, long, blonde-gray hair was pulled back into a knot at the nape of her neck. "You had a phone call," she said. "A man named Barnaby from Ajax Financial Recovery."
"Collection agency," Pete said. "The guy's been bugging me for weeks. I can't think why he'd call here when I just sent off a check. I told him it was in the mail, but he wouldn't back off. He's the kind of fellow can't admit he made a mistake."
"He said the account had been turned over to him because payment was overdue by 6 months. With late fees and charges, the total's $600.
"Well, then it's lucky I took care of it before they jacked up the total again. Ask me, it's a hell of a way to earn a living, harassing folks over something like that."
She studied his face carefully. "If you had problems, you'd let me know, wouldn't you?"
"Absolutely, I would. Happily, that's not the case. In fact, business is looking up. I've got an appointment at 1 o'clock that I think might net me a handsome chunk of change."
"But you know you can tell me, right? If there's a problem."
"When have I not? That was the deal we made how many years ago, coming up on 40 by my count."
He stretched out his hand on the table, and she laced her fingers into his.
"Speaking of which, I've got a surprise. I wasn't going to tell you, but it occurred to me I better give you fair warning."
He removed the brochure from his jacket pocket and placed it on the table, elaborating as he went. He showed her the route along the Danube, pointing out some of the stops on the itinerary. Budapest, Vienna, Passau. He was honest about not having the entire sum set aside, but he was getting there, he said. She didn't seem as excited as he'd hoped, but the idea might take some getting used to. They'd never traveled abroad. Europe was just a rumor as far as they were concerned. They had passports which they were careful to keep renewed, but they'd never had occasion to use them. Her spirit seemed to pick up as he told her about the accommodations. He had ways of making it seem real. Not an extravagance, but something they deserved after 40 years of being happily married and careful about the money they spent. They finished lunch. He cleared the table and made quick work of the dishes. By the time he left for his run to Colgate, she was her usual sunny self again, and he felt better. No point in being depressed when there was so much to look forward to. The meeting with Linton Reed started off on a bad note. Pete reached the university in ample time, but he was forced to drive around the campus in search of the health sciences building, which he hadn't spotted on the map he'd picked up at the campus information center. He pulled a ticket from the dispenser and circled the lot until he found a parking space. On reaching the clinic's administrative offices, he made a point of asking to have his parking ticket validated. In the event the conversation didn't go well, he didn't want to get stuck paying the campus parking fees. The department secretary didn't approve of his being there, but she didn't have the nerve to refuse to validate his ticket. She pasted 3 stickers to the back. He took a sly satisfaction from her dislike of him, which she could barely conceal. To retaliate, Pete was made to wait 35 minutes before he was escorted down the hall and allowed into his holy presence. The good doctor was handsome, smooth cheeks, clear blue eyes, fleshy lips, and a nose with a slight upward tilt to it. His was the kind of face most would trust. Dr. Reed's first glimpse of Pete had generated a nearly imperceptible flicker of surprise in the good doctor's eyes. Pete caught it. He always caught that look. Linton Reed observed him with clinical detachment, and Pete could see his mental processes at work. Dr. Reed had doubtless read about Pete's disorder in medical texts, but this might have been the first real live instance he'd come across. Naturally, that would make Pete a curiosity. Dr. Reed said, "Which of your parents suffered from Marfan syndrome?"
My father, Pete said.
He felt an instant dislike for the young man, who apparently thought his being a doctor entitled him to probe Pete's genetic history when the two had only just been introduced. Marfan was an autosomal dominant condition, which meant that a defective gene from only one parent was needed to pass the disease on. It also meant that each child of an affected parent has a 50-50 chance of inheriting the defective gene. It annoyed Pete that in his doctor role, Linton Reed had adopted a deeper tone of voice. This was meant to underscore his authority, conveying the rights vested in him as a medical wizard entitled to pry into everybody else's private business. The good doctor probably hoped to open up a whole discussion of Pete's condition, but Pete had something else on his mind. Linton Reed was a charmer and fully accustomed to exercising his personal magnetism. He was a sheepdog at heart. He looked harmless, but he couldn't resist herding his fellow man. He'd been born with an unerring instinct for bending others to his will. Pete had had a dog like that once, a border collie named Shep, who just couldn't help himself. Take a walk in the woods with friends, and Shep would dash ahead and behind, keeping everyone together whether they wanted that or not. The urge was inbred, and the implication was always that the dog knew better than you did. Pete loathed the man sitting across the desk from him. He remembered prigs like him in grade school. Smart, but soft from sitting on their big, fat, superior white asses while kids like Pete rose to the challenge of the bullies. Linton, shit, even his name was Prissy, would dissolve in tears while Pete fought down to the bitter end. His nose might be bloody and his shirt torn, the back of his pants streaked with dirt and grass stains, but the other guy always backed off first. His opponents took to coming after him with chains and stones, at which point he was sometimes forced to concede. Anything short of that, Pete was fearless. Dr. Reed adjusted his watch band, not checking the face, which would have been rude, but making his point nonetheless.
Ms. Sobel mentioned you had a personal matter to discuss. I'm here to do you a favor.
The set smile appeared.
And what might that be?
Pete opened the folder he'd brought with him and placed it on the desk. He wet his index finger and turned a page or two.
It's come to my attention that you're in a bit of a sticky situation.
Oh?
This is in regard to the Phase 2 clinical trials involving a drug called glucotase. I confess I don't understand all the nitty-gritty details, but according to my sources, the drug was originally intended for diabetics until it was taken off the market for what turned out to be, in some instances, fatal side effects. Your current hypothesis is that in combination with acamprosate and another drug,
naltrexone, which is in common use, studies have shown it mitigates the craving for alcohol. Pete held up a piece of paper.
I'm aware of that. It says so right here. Your theory is those two drugs, plus glucotase, might prove effective in the treatment of nicotine and alcohol addiction.
Statistics show alcoholic smokers are more prone to severe nicotine dependence than are non-alcoholics with higher smoking rates. Dr. Reed's tone was bemused and slightly professorial, as though Pete might benefit from enlightenment.
We're just beginning to address the relationship. And we appreciate your attention to the matter, Pete said. With regard to glucotase, your observation was that patients in treatment for alcohol dependence often develop a craving for sweets, which naturally plays havoc with their insulin levels. Your idea was to control glucose as a means of minimizing the peaks and valleys. Use of glucotase in this instance would be classified as off-label.
The doctor smiled.
And you know this how?
I'm just curious.
Get an NIH grant and much of this is public record. The rest I picked up on my own. Success here would go a long way toward boosting your career. Comes to publishing, you're already ahead of the curve. How many papers in this year alone? 47, by my count. You're a busy boy.
Some of those were co-authored.
Duly noted. I made a copy of the list.
Linton Reed's face remained blank. No herding behavior here.
I don't understand where you're going with this.
You want the long version or the short?
Dr. Reed's eyes were dead.
Keep it short.
There's been some suggestion you're cooking your data.
Pardon?
The clinical trial. You're manipulating the numbers, making them look better than they are. Something I gather you've done in the past.
There was that business in Arkansas, which I grant you was a problem of a different sort.
You don't know what you're talking about.
I may not know the whole of it, but I know enough. Whatever's going on is of no interest to me personally, but I gather it's of the utmost importance to you. You have that pretty little bride of yours. New home, the in-laws bought you. Nice car. Leave my private life out of this. Just pointing out how much you have to lose. Good job, all those high-class friends. This comes to light and you can kiss all that goodbye.
This conversation is over.
Conversation's over, but your jeopardy is not. I have an idea how you might sidestep disgrace. I'd be happy to spell it out if you're interested.
The good doctor's voice dropped into the manly range that must have served him so well in other circumstances.
If you don't leave my office this minute, I'll call security.
Pete stood and took out a business card that he placed on the desk.
I'd give it some thought. You've got a lot at stake, and you can't afford to get caught out. Even the accusation of trimming, founded or unfounded, would open up a can of worms, especially in light of your previous infractions.
Get out of here!
Call if you want to chat, buddy.
I'm here for you.
Linton Reed was already reaching for the phone, prepared to summon the troops. Pete left in as unhurried a manner as he could muster, refusing to admit the doctor had struck fear in him with the threat of campus gendarmes. The secretary studiously avoided looking at him as he passed, which was fine with him. He returned to his car, and when he pulled up to the exit gate, he noticed the kiosk was empty and the parking attendant was nowhere to be seen. Pete waited a moment, then got out of the car and walked around the rear until he reached the kiosk window. He peered over the sill, reached in, and activated the mechanism that raised the gate. Then he got back in his car and pulled out. The validated ticket he stuffed in the glove compartment, in case he had some future use for it. Pete headed for home. He'd planted the seed, and now he'd leave it to Dr. Reed to follow the thread to its logical conclusion. Give him a week, and he'd cave. What struck Pete as weird was he didn't feel that good about the deal. There was something depressing about the whole thing. Linton Reed was a bad egg. He was a man who cut corners, and to date he'd managed to tap dance out of harm's way using his considerable charm and his good looks. The encounter should have given Pete the satisfaction for a job well done. In truth, he was weary beyond belief. Maybe it was time to retire. Ruthie made excellent money, and it wouldn't be a problem getting by on what she earned. Essentially, that's what they'd been doing for the past 18 months. The house was paid for, and their expenses were minimal. She must know how broke he was. She could probably see through Pete's pie-in-the-sky claim of imminent financial gain. She knew him better than he knew himself. And what he loved about her was she'd never dream of calling him on his shit. She was protective of him. She made it possible for him to save face. In the meantime, it crossed his mind that if the good doctor never called him, it might be reason to rejoice. They'd find a way to survive. If the good doctor didn't call, he'd take it as a sign and he'd hang up his spurs. At the office, first thing the next morning, his phone rang. He nearly let the call go to the answering machine, but for once he picked up. Linton Reed said, "What do you want?"
"Whatever you think it's worth."
"I'm not going to pay you."
"Why would I do that?"
"You're way off. You don't know the first thing."
"You don't want to pay, we have nothing to discuss."
"Whatever you think you have on me, you're dead wrong. What you're attempting is extortion. I'll call the FBI.
Pete felt something sour rise in his throat.
"I'm not talking about money to keep quiet. I'm talking about making the threat evaporate. You got a problem? I got a plan.
For which I pay."
"Everybody pays for services. That's how business is done."
"How do I know you won't come back for more?"
"Because once I neutralize the danger, that's the end of it."
"What are you, a hitman?"
"What's the matter with you? I don't hurt people for any reason. I'd never do such a thing. At any rate, I don't think this is something we should discuss on the phone. Why don't we find a place to meet? That way we can pursue the matter in private and see if we can reach an agreement."
There was a long silence, and Pete waited it out. Finally, tersely, the good doctor said,
"Where?"
Chapter 21.
I followed Alice as she crossed the back porch and went down the wooden stairs. Lolly sat in a shady spot under a cottonwood tree on one of two metal lawn chairs. These were duplicates of the ones I remembered from the scrim of yard in the trailer park where I'd lived with Aunt Jin. Metal back and seat, supported by a continuous bend of U-shaped tubing, which gave the chairs some bounce. The finish here was chalky from sun exposure, but the chairs were otherwise in great shape. Between the two, there was a metal table resting on three legs. The larger part of the backyard was given over to a vegetable garden, densely planted and still producing cherry tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, and two kinds of squash. The beds were bordered with dark green kale and bright orange marigolds. The roses along the fence had been pruned to short, blunt sticks. Alice said,
"Lolly, this is Kinsey. She's a friend of Terence and Evelyn Dace. They live next door to you and David on Daisy Lane. Do you remember them?"
"Oh, yes. It's so nice to see you again," she said,
and then looked at her cousin, waiting for the next cue.
Alice said, "I'm going to bring you some lemonade. You can tell Kinsey about the garden."
And then to me, "Lolly designed the beds when she first came to live with me, and now we work awfully hard to keep them in shape. I'll be right back."
She returned to the house, leaving me alone with Lolly, who looked every bit of her 86 years, big-boned and gaunt, with wide shoulders and a wide, sloping bosom that disappeared at her waist. Her eyes were buried in soft folds. The dress she wore was cotton with an old-fashioned faded floral print in blues and pinks. She wore opaque beige stockings and sandals with thick straps. She had a colander in her lap, and she was shelling peas, though the results were a jumble of torn and broken pods with the occasional spill of bright green. Once in a while she looked down, puzzled by the sight, but unable to correct for the error in play. Her expression was probably one she'd settled on for most occasions, pleasant but with a fixed quality, like someone traveling in a foreign country, unacquainted with the language and therefore hoping to avoid conversation. She flicked an anxious look toward the back door and then leaned close.
"Who is that woman?"
"Your cousin, Alice. Your mother and hers were sisters." Lolly's expression was anxious.
"Alice is young. That woman's old. She moved into my house and now she's bossing me around. What right does she have to give orders?"
I felt myself detach from reality for a quick reassessment. My neighbor Gus had fallen into the hands of an unscrupulous caregiver who operated in this same manner, discounting complaints and suggesting psychological problems where there were none. If Gus told anyone how mistreated he was, the listener's natural inclination was to write him off as a mental case. For all I knew, Lolly was telling me the truth. At the same time, if Alice was indeed a stranger taking advantage of an elderly woman, she wouldn't have allowed me to see Lolly in the first place, would she have? "I just met her," I said. "I called and asked if I could visit, and she agreed. I've never seen her before in my life, have you?" "Not until just now," I said. "Do you remember Terence and Evelyn Dace?"
"Of course. Are you a friend of Evelyn's?"
"No, but I talked to her children, Ethan,
Ellen, and Anna,"
she said, filling in the family tree. I was thinking, good, we're back on track. "Do you remember the name Karen Coffey?"
"Oh, yes. She went missing in February, and they found her days later stuffed in that culvert not 2 miles from Daisy Lane. She'd been raped and strangled with a cord. I felt so bad for the family. They were members of my church."
"You have a good memory."
"Do I?"
she asked, and then hesitantly, "Have you seen my daughter, Mary?"
"I don't know Mary. I wish I did," I said.
"Were you at Terence and Evelyn's house the night Karen Coffey disappeared?"
"I was. David and I went next door at 6 o'clock for a potluck supper. I brought a 3-bean salad and homemade rolls. Evelyn made that casserole she does with cauliflower, sour cream, and grated cheese. I've asked for the recipe 4 times, but she won't give it to me, which I told David is just typical of her."
"Did you have a pleasant evening?"
"We did. The pastor of our church and his wife were there. We had supper, and then talked about raising money for the new Sunday school building."
"David's your husband?"
"Yes, but you know, he went out some time ago and hasn't come back since. He'll be upset if he hears that woman's been bossing me around. Do you know who she is?"
"I believe she's your cousin, Alice."
"The visiting nurse said the same thing, but I know Alice, and that's not her."
"Do you remember where Terence was that night?"
"At the house with the rest of us. The pastor's wife brought meatloaf, which I thought was too dry, though please don't repeat what I said. When Terence went to the store for ice cream, the pastor halted the discussion, thinking he might have something to add when he got back. Evelyn told him vanilla, and he bought peppermint. Was she upset? Oh, my stars, that woman can throw a fit. Are you a friend of hers?"
"I haven't met her," I said. "What's she like?"
"Crazy as a loon."
She crossed her eyes, stuck her tongue out of the side of her mouth, and made a circle with her index finger at her temple. "Lolly, can you tell me who's president of the United States?" She leaned forward and put a finger to her lips.
"I didn't vote for him. Don't tell."
"What's his name again?"
"Richard Nixon."
I stayed long enough for half a glass of lemonade and some inconsequential chat. I kept a discreet eye on my watch, and at 9:45 I excused myself, saying I had to get back to the hotel in order to check out. I thanked Lolly for her time. I thanked Alice for allowing me to come. When she accompanied me back through the house to the front door, I saw no sign of the flowers or the box of candy I'd brought. I hoped Lolly got something out of the deal. Did I trust her recollection? I most certainly did. I crossed the lobby of the Holiday Inn on my way to the elevators. I'd planned to check out before Mamie and Evelyn arrived.